I'm Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. If you have been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. That's an important part, that this was our course. We learn how to do that. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Which brings us to step 5. I'm not going to talk too much about step 5, except a real thumbnail sketch. It says in the big book, one of the best reasons for doing step 5 is if you don't do it, you're probably not going to stay sober. That's a good reason. It's one of 6 places in the big book that comes out point blank and says, look, if this isn't happening, you're probably not going to stay sober. So that's a good, and then it goes on to explain why, because we have a tendency to live a double life. You know, we have this, it talks about the stage character we present in AA and then the secret person we know we really are. And I don't think alcoholics can live in that kind of inconsistency for long. The separation eats our lunch. The fear of being found out eats our lunch. And then it says on 74 and 75, it tells you who to take your fifth step with. And it says it should be a closed-mouthed, understanding person. Very important. I think hearing a fifth step is sacred ground. And I have a sacred obligation to keep my mouth shut. And if you are the type of person who you leak information like a sieve, and you have an inability to keep your mouth shut, doesn't make you a bad person. You're welcome in AA, but you probably shouldn't hear fifth steps. Go wash ashtrays or something, but don't hear fifth steps because it's sacred ground. Because the stuff that you start blabbing around that somebody told you in confidence in a fifth step could kill them if they have not grown through it enough to accept that as public knowledge, especially when it comes to things that people are real ashamed of, secrets. Page 75, fifth step promises, middle of the page. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. That might be the first promise. Some of us haven't been delighted about anything in years. We can look the world in the eye. I remember being new, looking at people's shoes. I remember being new, feeling so ashamed of myself and so phony and so afraid of being found out. I had this anxiety, this feeling that if you really looked deep within my eyes, you would see the disgusting person I really believed me to be inside. It's hard for me to look people in the eye. Somewhere after step, as a result of these steps, especially 5, and getting clean with these all this stuff, I could start to do that with ease. The second promise, we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. I could not do that for a long time. I couldn't be alone with my head. I remember trying it at about a little over three months sober, I think. I was in a meeting, and I was listening to this, one of the clubs, listening to this woman who was obviously sober a long time and had worked the steps, and she was pretty good shape. And she was talking about alone time. And the way she talked about it made it so attractive. She said how she liked to just be alone by herself and kind of commune with herself, and how much she enjoyed just being alone with herself. No music, no TV, just alone time with herself. And the way she said it, it sounded so attractive. I thought, yeah, I want to do that. And I went back to my apartment. I went in. Nobody's there. I'm all by myself. I didn't turn the TV on. Didn't turn the stereo. I'm going to commune with me. And I'll tell you something. When it got quiet out here, it got noisy in here. And after about 30 seconds, I couldn't take it anymore. I had to go turn the TV set on because I'm just going. My head just started on me. What are you going to think about? What are you going to do? What are you sitting here for? This is crazy. I don't know what you're going to do. Oh, geez, that's just nuts. That's nuts. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease today. Not only can I be, I must be. I have time every day in the morning and some time, a little bit of time at night. When I, just me and God, me in here, and it's good. It's good. It's essential. It's fresh air for my spirit. Important stuff. But I couldn't do it then. It says our fears fall from us. Not too long after doing step five, I found myself a fear falling from me that I didn't even know I had. I got in my car one night, and I'm sitting in the driver's seat, and I'm driving away, and I drive a little way down the street, and I realized I did not look in the back seat of my car before I got in. And I was astounded because I always did. I didn't even know that that was a fear. I don't know what I'm afraid is going to be lurking back there, but I just always looked back there before I got in the car. And I'm driving down. I thought it was bizarre. I didn't even have to turn around and look. I just kept on driving. And it fell. I didn't even deal with that. It just was removed from me. I guess as I was opening the channel to God, I started to feel more protected, more closer to Him. It says we begin, the next promise is we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. I think it's step five is really where you begin the process of lightening your spirit, awakening your spirit in step five. It really comes to fruition in step nine when... It's funny about step nine. The book and the promises, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through our eight-step list. But I tell you, in my spirit, there's a big difference between doing all your amends and doing all but two. There's a big difference, I'm telling you. Those two that you hold on to make a big difference in here. That's really... I watch guys sober 20, 30 years that are financial disaster areas. And if they get... I'm working with one right now, and it all came out. It's because of some unmade financial amends that he swept under the rug. But there ain't nowhere to sweep it. Don't go nowhere. Don't go nowhere. So he sabotaged his life unconsciously for all these years. Yep. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. I remember getting that. I remember the moment. I remember a sense of it was like an elated sense of hope. And I remember thinking to myself for the first time that I wasn't cured, But I remember thinking, you know, God, I could, you know, if I kept doing this, I might really, really be able to stay sober the rest of my life if I kept doing this one day at a time. I could maybe really do this. I think up until that time, this was some kind of another treatment, self-help deal. I was just waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know what I mean? Because I've done that. You know, I've gone to seminars and therapists and treatment centers that have changed my life for 6 months. You know what I mean? And then you're back. Then there you are again with you. But I started getting a feeling after step five that, not that I was fixed or that the drink problem had been solved, but I started getting a lot of hope that this thing could work. This could work for me. We feel we are on a broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Returning home after doing step five, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. This is a very important paragraph. This is the first place in the process where the book says, okay, you've been going wham, 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 right along. Now we want you to stop for an hour. And we want you to take an inventory, essentially, of what you've done so far, the first five steps. And you and God are going to take a look at what you've done so far, and we're going to plug any holes that exist in the foundation, because we're going to go on with some stuff that's very important. And you're not going to be able to go on with that stuff if the holes aren't plugged. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. So I'm going to sit alone at home for an hour and look back over my fourth and fifth step. Then I say a prayer. The prayer is, it says, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. I tell guys, say that prayer. I had one guy years ago say to me, he said, what if I don't feel like it? I know him better. I said, hey, it doesn't say only thank him if you feel like it. Just do it. And maybe it's a leap of faith. Maybe what you really feel is tired and washed out. But maybe we're going to trust that I have just cleaned some stuff away between me and him. And whether I feel like it at the moment or not, that I am actually closer to God. And I will thank him from the bottom of my heart for the opportunity. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, beginning at chapter 5. Carefully reading the first five proposals, first five steps, and we say another prayer. It says, we ask God if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. I've heard, I don't even know how many fifth steps, 100, 150, I have no idea, a lot. On many occasions, many, many occasions, I've sent guys home to do this. And 45 minutes later, I'll get a phone call. Bob? Yeah? I forgot something. Did you say the prayer? Yep. Popped up, didn't it? Yep. What is it? Well, I stole some money at work. Oh, really? How much? $450,000. Oh, yeah, I forgot that, did you? Or a guy will call up, Bob, forgot to tell you about something. What's that? Didn't tell you about the sheep. Sheep. Whatever it is. There's something that often happens when I'm alone with God and I ask that prayer. I say, God, have I admitted anything? And it's not unusual that something we have not consciously admitted, but admitted just the same, will just rise to the surface. And it's, you pick up the phone, you go back to see the guy, you do whatever's necessary to get clean with it. And then it asks some questions. It says, is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement, put into the foundation, have tried to make mortar without sand? If we're good with the first five steps, and we can, in the top of page 76, it says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we're good with first five, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. It's perfectly all right. We say this prayer. If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. There's nothing I'm required to do in Alcoholics Anonymous I can't do. If I get to step 6 and I've just done my 5th step and I got some defects of character that have been driving me, lust and greed, and the real truth is I understand intellectually that I really should be free of this. But the real truth is I don't really want to give them up yet. I don't want to give up all my dishonesty, because what if I ever get in a bad financial crunch? Can I reserve the right to wiggle a little bit? To just shave the truth a little bit to get a little edge? I mean, if it's really in a bad spot, you know? Or what if I really asked God to take away my lust and he did? Then what? What if I ask him to take away my greed? And he did. Would I still go to work? Would I have any ambition? And I think it's perfectly all right to be afraid. Because what are my defects of character really, except defective defense mechanisms that I've used to prop myself up, give me a false sense of security, protect me, take care of me? Now, intellectually, I may understand that they don't work. But there's a big gap, an abyss, between intellectually knowing you should give up something and giving it up. I was addicted to cigarettes for a lot of years, and I'll tell you something. I knew for years I should quit. I'm telling you something. There's a big difference between knowing you should quit and quitting. Big difference. I knew for years I should stop drinking. I'd go into bars and order another drink. Tell them, you know, I really should cut this shit out. I got it. Big difference between intellectually understanding that this is objectionable and being entirely ready. Entirely ready is an inside job. Entirely ready comes from God's grace. Entirely ready comes from the opportunity of failure and grace coming together. And I'll tell you what I believe in my experiences with step 6 is step 6 has been the story of the last 25 years of my life. It's been the story of my sobriety. It's been the story of how I've become really entirely ready to give up some things that I kind of wish still worked. Because maybe at one time they did. To give up some things that I'm secretly afraid to live without. Some defense mechanisms that propped me up and that gave me at one time an illusion of security and validation. And it's the story of how I become entirely ready. And I tell you what I've discovered sometimes I become entirely ready by asking for God's grace, and he gives it to me, and I get it, and I connect the dots, and I walk, and I give it up. And other times, I can't. Other times, the way God's grace works in my life is I got to wear it out. You know, I got to take a defective character that no longer works, and yet I still have an illusion that it might, and I got to wear it out till it's a smoldering, stinking carcass that's dead on the floor, and then I still ain't ready to walk away. I'm going to kick it again, see if I can get it to get up and ride. Right? I did that with my drinking. The last 3 years of my drinking, that's how I got sober. That's how I came to AA. I would have never come to AA during the fun years. I'm drinking. I'm not an idiot. I didn't even come here when there was a lot of problems. I had to go all the way into the phase where they have wrung every ounce of fun out of it. It's all problems. It's all terrible. And now I still tried it for another 2 years just hoping I could get back to that, right? And I had to take it that far. And I've had to take some of my character defects that far, right? Not because I'm a bad guy. It is my nature to be that way. And one of the great things about my life from step three on is it's not my business. God is the director of my life. God is who He is building with me and doing with me. And it's real easy to look at members of my home group and say, you should have got over that by now. Well, God, I wonder what they're saying about me. Right? You know what I'm saying? Because it's in God's time. And AA, one of the great differences between AA and like a lot of churches and stuff, and a lot of churches, if you're a sinner, they want you to come to their church. They invite you in. They make you real welcome. But they kind of expect you to stop sinning. I mean, it's implied in the literature. In AA, we're almost the opposite. We say, sin as long as you can stand it. Matter of fact, oh, you're doing that? Oh, yeah, go ahead and do that. Oh, you're going to really help some people one day when you hit a bottom with that. I'm telling you. No, really, because it's the weird crap in my life that I crash and burn with and survive that 3 years later becomes the most useful stuff I got when I'm running into a guy that's thinking about offing himself sober because he's jacked his life off. I can sit there and say, come along with me. I want to tell you what I did at 5 years sober. I want to tell you what I did at 10 years sober. I want to tell you how I jacked my paycheck off in a casino. I want to tell you about me. I want to let you know you're not alone and there's a way to get grace in your life even when you feel unworthy of it. And my worst things about me in sobriety have become some of my greatest assets. Really. I've often wondered why God doesn't remove all my defects of character. And I'll tell you what I've discovered. I was very dishonest for a long time with me about some of this stuff. And I would whine to people about how God's not taken away my defects of character. But I tell you the truth about some of it is that I don't really want Him to. And what I do is I go to Him and I ask Him to remove the thing, but I don't really want Him to take away the defect. I want Him to take away the consequences. And every defect of character has two parts. In Bill's story, there's a part of his story where he goes through a thumbnail sketch of the 12 steps. And he talks about steps 6 and 7, and he talks about defects of character in that part of the book differently than he talks about them anywhere else in AA literature. He refers to them, he's coming from the Oxford group place, so he calls them sins, but he's talking about steps 6 and 7, and he says he asked his creator to remove them, root and branch. Two parts. See, I want God to remove the branch because it's poking me in the eye, but I want to hold on to the root, which is where I get the illusion of validation and security. And the problem is you can't be free of one without the other. It's a package. That's like trying to say to God, remove the hangovers, but let me drink. You know, you can't have one without the other. They are connected. They are part and parcel of the same experience. Every defect of character has a price and consequences, and it also has a cookie. It has a goodie attached to it. And Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about these steps 4 through 9 as a process of uncovering, discovering, and then ultimately discarding the thing in me that's blocking me. And I have to not only uncover it, but I have to discover the truth. Fracture the illusion of validation and see what's really going on. And that's where God's grace is paramount. I think a lot of my defects of character, my experience with step 6 is very similar to the guy who goes to the psychiatrist and he's beside himself. He's a nervous wreck and he goes into the psychiatrist. He says, Doc, help me, please. My life's a mess. I really need your help. And the psychiatrist says, well, sure. What's going on? And he says, well, My brother-in-law lives with me, and he's crazy, Doc. He's insane. He thinks he's a chicken. Every morning when the sun runs up, gets up, he's running up and down this block naked, flapping his arms and clucking. The cops are at my house all the time. The neighbors will have nothing to do with me. I am an embarrassment in the community. Please, Doc, I can't live like this anymore. Will you do something? And the psychiatrist said, well, sure. Here, sign these committal papers, and I'll put your brother-in-law in the state mental hospital, and your problems are over. The guy says, oh, yeah, but Doc, I don't know if I can live without the eggs. Well, there's eggs in every defect of character. I don't hang on to stuff that hurts me because I'm self-destructive. I hang on to it because there's a secret illusion of validation or value somewhere in it that I secretly can't imagine life without. They're my defense mechanisms that are defective. And I have to give them up. In the 1940s, the Japanese Empire was faced with a tremendous, tremendous thing. As a result of two nuclear weapons being dropped on two of their major cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were faced with ultimate and complete destruction as a nation. And they had no defense. There was nothing they could do. They had no atomic bombs. They had no defensive weapons that could stop that. There was nothing that they can do. And I don't think that a harder, more wrought surrender was ever made. And they made that surrender in face of the knowledge of what they did at Pearl Harbor and what they did to our prisoners of war and of all our soldiers and people they'd killed. Of the ships they'd ambushed and sunk. And they didn't have a choice. They were faced ultimate destruction and annihilation as some of us felt like we were dying. And they signed the formal terms of surrender, which would have been, in a sense, their step three. But that was not enough. They were required to do an inventory of all their defenses, their planes, their ships, their tanks. They had to disband their standing army, air force, navy. And they had to make this inventory of all their defensive weapons and turn over all their defenses to their enemy, what they thought was their enemy, and render themselves defenseless in order to carry out the surrender. It was not enough to sign. If they would have signed the papers and continued to maintain the defenses in the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, the war would have never stopped. They had to give up. You know, and as a result of that surrender and their carrying out the actions that they decided to carry out in the terms of the surrender, and they've never reneged, they never created a standing army, they never turned up their arms industry again. They've stuck to it. And within 40 years, the Japanese ended up owning more of the United States than they could have ever conquered or maintained through military means. I'm telling you. They became one of the most richest, productive, affluent nations in the world as a result of giving up, and they stopped defending themselves. And you know what happened when they stopped defending themselves? Help poured into Japan. It just poured in. And when I stop defending myself and protecting myself, grace pours in. But you cannot be defended and surrendered at the same time. They are mutually exclusive positions. I can't stand there with a shield and a sword saying, I surrender. It ain't going to happen. I must act like someone who has surrendered and give up my defenses. And that's really what step 6 and 7 is about. It's giving up the things that, and uncovering the reasons I hang on to them. I have always wanted to be free of the discomfort of resentment the hollow, gnawing feeling, the thing that makes my head spin where I can't sleep because I lay my head on the pillow and I think about what I'll say to that son of a bitch and what I'll, you know, that I hate that. I want to be free of that. But am I willing to give up the pleasure of judgment? Well, you can't be free of one without the other. In order to be free of the resentments, I have to give up the judgment. What if I gave up all my judgment? What would I use to make me feel, to attempt to make me feel better on a spiritually bad hair day? You know those days where you feel awful and it just kind of gives you a sick sense of fun to feel someone that looks worse than you and judge them and make them, you know, feel like you're superior? What would I do to try to, in a frantic way, to make myself feel better, except that that doesn't work? That's why I'm willing to give up a lot of that stuff, because I wear it out. It doesn't really make me valid or whole or complete. It doesn't really make me more secure. I just think it does. God is either everything or he's nothing. Either is or he isn't. Page 53 says, Bob, under that light, what's your choice going to be? In the seven-step prayer, it says, when ready, we say something like this. My creator. If he is my creator, he is all of me. He's created it. There's nothing I am that God is not. My creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. That's a novel idea for some of us. I came to AA secretly thinking that for me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, if I really were to surrender, I better clean my act up first and get good. The idea that God could take unto himself all of me, flawed, that I don't have to be perfect yet, I don't even have to have gotten really a lot better, that God, I could offer myself to, is flawed and is incomplete and is vacant and is pitifully judgmental at times and self-centered and fearful, and that I could do that? I am willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. It's a tremendous prayer. Every time I read it, I am amazed that Bill Wilson wrote it, because I know Bill Wilson was like me. Self-centered, self-concerned, self-consumed. I would have never written this prayer. I would have said part of it. I would have said the first part. My creator, I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which, I wouldn't have said, stands in the way of my usefulness. I would have said that stands in the way of everyone realizing what a terrific guy Bob is. Or at the very least, it stands in the way of my being rich and famous and happy. Don't I get at least happy? I'd at least said happy. Wouldn't you have said happy? That stands in the way of my being happy. Don't I get happy? Right? Because the great call of the alcoholic is, yeah, helping the people. Oh, that's all great. But what about me here? It doesn't even say that. It has nothing to do with me. It stands in the way of my usefulness. My usefulness. Maybe because that's the way it is. Maybe that's why God leaves some stuff that sometimes causes me discomfort. Maybe because if he ever took everything away and rendered me white as snow, that I would be absolutely useless, really. I don't imagine I'm much different than most of us. I'll tell you what I'm like when I'm having a bad day. I mean a bad day. I need help when I'm having a bad day. When I've done something that I feel really bad about myself for, like I want to go out in the garden and eat worms. Maybe I didn't eat all day and I went to a restaurant and the waitress was really slow and I just flipped out on her and read her the riot act and stormed out of there. And now I feel awful. And I can't go back in there again. Or maybe I've, as I did in my early sobriety, gambled away my whole paycheck and I don't have any money for rent or cigarettes or gas and I can't get to work. And I already owe my roommate money from last month's rent and I can't face him and I can't face my boss because I owe him money because I gambled the week before. When I'm like that, a guy that is a saint is not going to be any use. You know what I need? I need a guy that did the same thing last year and lived through it. Because first of all, before I can ever apply any light to this, any spiritual principles, the first thing I have to do is I have to deal with the separation. Because that stuff separates me apart and puts me in a corner in a feeling like I am all alone and I'm different from all of you and I've lost my sense of community. I'm no longer part of the realm of the Spirit. I am separate and apart from. And what I need, the guy that can be the most useful to me at that moment is somebody who maybe 2 weeks before gambled his paycheck and now he's been 2 weeks without a bet. Or maybe a guy that I heard talk in a meeting last week about how he read the riot act to some waitress who didn't wait on him right and how he wanted to go back and make amends. That's the guy that I need to talk to. I don't want to talk to no saint. Because I'm going to feel less than, I'm not going to be able to. There was a guy in Vegas who died a few years ago. Old timer, sober 40 some years. His name was Bill. And I loved Bill. On a good day, Bill was one of my favorite members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But Bill used to always share about how it was a happy program and he'd never had a bad day since he got sober. When I was having a bad day, I avoided Bill. I'm telling you, I'm not going to share. I remember coming into a meeting one time and I just felt awful. And I had some problems at work and problems in a relationship and I needed to talk to someone. And Bill is not the guy I'm going to talk to. I could talk to Bill about A stuff on a good day. But I can't talk to someone that exhibits an error and says stuff in meetings like he's never had a bad day since he got sober. I don't want to talk to him when I'm having a bad day. Now, afterwards, a day or two later, I can go talk to him after I've quieted the disturbance. But you know the guys I found? I needed to find the guys that weren't perfect. They were the most useful to me, really. And so maybe that's why. That some of us we never outgrow our humanness here, we never get over it. The delusion that we're going to get over our alcoholism ain't going to happen. I might keep my head in the clouds with God and be spiritually centered, but my feet should always be on the earth with you guys. My feet should always be right in the trenches of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the prisons, in the skid row, detoxes, in the halfway houses, where I can be most useful. That everything that has ever been wrong with me in my life and every mistake I've ever made will come to bear in a weapon against the disease of alcoholism for these people who suffer from alcoholism. For the first time in my life, the worst things about me, the things I hated and despised the most, become useful. Amazing stuff, what happens in God's hands. How things turn around like that. I would have never imagined that that some of these things could be useful. That brings us to step 9. I'm going to go real quick through this. I think step 9, I could talk a whole day on step 9. It's probably one of the most important steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of the people, my experience with, I get a lot of guys that come to me with 15 and 20 years of sobriety that have destroyed their life sober and ask me to work with them. And usually they've left out big chunks of step 9. And they left them out not because they're bad guys. They left them out because they thought they could. and nobody was breathing down their neck to pay back some of that stuff. Some of that stuff nobody even knew they owed, except they knew, and they couldn't. You can't really get away from the truth within you. You may sweep it under the rug, but 5 years later it surfaces. Step nine was the step that terrified me the most. When I was new, I remember looking at it and just being overwhelmed. I thought, oh my God, I can't do that. I can't do that. If I would have known I had to pay that back someday, I would have never stolen all that shit. I can't. It's too much. It's too big. It's too awful. I looked around AA, and I thought, the people in AA can make amends. You're good people. I can tell by looking at you. You're nice people, kind people. You're kind to me. I bet you you're kind. You've always been that way. You're good people. Go make amends. Good for you. You probably embarrassed your family. Go say you're sorry. You probably padded your expense account at work. Go make it right. Good for you. But I lived like an animal on the streets. Guys went to prison as a result of my actions because I dimed them out in order to save my own life so I wouldn't go to prison. How are you to make amends to guys like that? Career criminals and outlaw motorcycle gangs, gang guys that went to prison because of you. How do you make amends for that? How do you make amends to parents that all they ever did was love you and you just battered them and broke their heart over and over and over and over again until you've destroyed them? Till your mother is on tranquilizers and in therapy and your father sleeps 15, 16 hours a day. How do you make amends to a sister who's ruined her life because her older brother is always in the newspaper and the kids at school make fun of her because he's a gangster? I wasn't really a gangster, even though I fancied myself. The police told me the truth. They said, you're not a gangster, you're a public nuisance. How do you make amends to a guy that was your best friend, that you took a hunting knife and you opened his chest up and he lived, but he'd never be the same? How do you make amends to the friend of yours that you don't know where he is, that you ripped his brother off and let him take the blame and it just split their family right in half and they never would speak to each other again? How do you make amends to the nameless, faceless people that you robbed, the purses you stole, and the cars you broke into, and the houses you burglarized, and the people, the nameless people that you ripped off in drug deals and you held guns on? How do you make amends to them? I don't even know their names. And my experience with step 8 and 9 was very similar to the experience of a kid in third or fourth grade. If he were to sit down one day and look at the tests that he must pass in order to graduate from high school, a kid in the third or fourth grade looking at those tests would become overwhelmed. He'd look at those tests and if he was like me, he'd feel, I might as well quit school. I'll never, ever be able to pass those tests. I'll never be able to answer those questions. I will never even be able to understand those questions. But a funny thing happens if he shows up one day at a time and does the next indicating thing, the next goes to the next class, the next homework assignment, reads the next chapter. By the time he gets to the end of the 12th grade, he has everything in place within him to take those tests. And AA is kind of like that. Carl Jung was one of the first I ever heard talk of or read about that talked about a principle that is the fabric of AA. The principle of synchronicity. It's a description of God's grace, and how it works and how it seems to work in my life and a lot of us is that I need to change. I need to do some things that can't be done. I need to go from point A to point B, but between the two points is an abyss I cannot surmount. And I need to do it. And I make the commitment and the willingness to make the change, even though it is absolutely impossible for me to go from point A to point B. And from the moment of commitment, the universe gets in motion to start providing a vehicle to go from A to B that did not exist prior to my willingness to make the jump. And I have seen that happen in this principle of synchronicity and how God's grace works in my life and my amends over the years is things of, you know, I had to break my 8-step list into 4 parts. And I tell the guys that I sponsor to do the same thing because there's really 4 types of amends on your 8-step list when you think about it. Because there's 2 factors that are involved. It says if we haven't the willing to do this when we're facing people that we, the idea of making amends, it says we ask for the willingness to make the amends and we ask until it comes. In step 8, step 8 says we made a list of all persons we'd harmed, and in the book it says we made it when we took our inventory. So it comes right off our 4-step list. All my resentments, the people I have judged harshly and hated and retaliated against, are all my 8-step list. All my fear of creditors, of all the people I'm afraid of facing and showing up in my life and ever running into, all go on my 8-step list. All my sexual encounters where I've been selfish and people got hurt, those people all go on my 8-step list. It's my job to make the list and ask for the willingness. It's God's job to provide the willingness and the opportunity because it says made direct amends wherever possible. It's God's job to create the wherever. There's nothing I have to do in AA I can't do. So I pray for the willingness. God needs to provide the willingness and the opportunity. And I've had people in my life that I had no idea how to find them. I had one gal... I searched for her. 17 years sobriety, she just popped up out of nowhere in my life. And I found out later why she popped up, why I could not find her at 4 years. I searched for her. Flew back east looking for her. Searched the town, talked to people, tried to find her, could not find her. 17 years sober, she pops up in my life. Wasn't even looking for her. Because a guy that was an old friend of mine who I was probably the worst drunk he ever saw. Just got out of Chit Chat Farms Treatment Center for his 2nd or 3rd time, and she was a friend of his. And I got to make the amends to her so she could put me and him together so he could come to AA and get sober. Right? I didn't see that was happening. God creates the wherever. So I got 4 columns in step 8. Column number 1. People, I know where they are, I got the wherever, and I'm willing to make the amends. Easy column, just go do it. Just go do it. Column number 2. People, I know where they are, but the truth is I ain't ready to face them yet, honestly. So I got the wherever, but I don't have the willingness. So I do what it says in the book. I ask for the willingness. I ask until it comes. Column number 3. I got the willingness. I would really like to make amends to these people, but I don't know where they are. I don't know how to find them. So they go on that list, and God must provide the wherever. And when they pop up in my life, he's already given me the willingness, I'd make the amends. And then the column number 4, I don't know where they are, and if I did screw them, I ain't going to go face them. God's got to provide me both the willingness and the wherever. And in those, every amends I've ever had to make will fall into one of those 4 categories. And I need from God one of those 2 things, either the willingness or the opportunity. I need one or the other. And it's my job to pray for the willingness, and it's God's job to provide the willingness and provide the opportunity. And he will do it in a synchronous manner, in divine order. And he always does it in a win-win situation. Always. I've had some tough amends to make in my life. I'll tell you real briefly about the hardest one, one of the hardest ones I ever had to make. And I think one of the reasons it was so hard, it was for stuff I did sober. When I was about a little less than a year sober, probably a year, close to a year sober, I went to work as a cashier in a store for minimum wage. And I was working in this store, and I was struggling, and I'm trying to start making amends to some things that were breathing. I had to start paying back, and I had some stuff to the courts I was still trying to take care of, and some other stuff, and I'm living paycheck to paycheck. And I had a tremendous cigarette habit back in those days. I was smoking 3 packs a day. And I remember one Thursday afternoon I was at work and I ran out of cigarettes and I didn't have any money because tomorrow was payday. And one of the things that we sold at that store was cigarettes. So I thought to myself, as I usually do, I thought to myself, I'll take a pack of cigarettes and then tomorrow when I get my paycheck, I'll cash my paycheck and I'll ring it up. It made perfect sense, logical, good thing. It was okay. Nothing seemed too out of line with that. Seemed reasonable. Took the pack of cigarettes. Tomorrow came. I remember getting my paycheck. And I'm cashing the paycheck. And the fleeting thought went through my mind. I should ring up those cigarettes. But you know, I come to work early. And I stay late sometimes. And I work harder than anybody here. And you know, I bet you everybody does this kind of thing. I bet you it's factored into the cost of operation. I mean, I look at all the extra stuff I did. So I sweeped it under the rug. And within no time at all, I'm supporting my cigarette habit 100% by just taking them. And I don't even get it. And within no time at all, not only am I supporting a 3-pack a day habit, which is better than two cartons a week, but I'm stealing a 6-pack of Diet Coke on my weekend. Take home with me. And I'm not thinking nothing of it. And all the justification is in place, the rationalization. But I'll tell you something about me in the world, in the realm of the spirit. If I'm trying to recover and heal my spirit, there's a funny thing that happens. I will take actions over here, and I don't get sick over here. Sometimes I get sick over here and over here. And I don't connect the dots. And what started happening to me is I started going to AA meetings and judging myself right out of AA. You know what it seemed like all of a sudden? It seemed like everybody in AA was dishonest and phony. It seemed like there was a lot of hypocrites in AA that weren't walking like they talk. It seemed like all of a sudden that there was some... I remember this. I was dating this girl at the time and I started really picking her apart and finding fault with her. And the boss that I worked for, who really was a great boss, he'd never mistreated me, always treated me right. I started picking him apart in my mind and putting him down. And I'm getting lonelier and sicker and I'm getting weird. And one night I get down on my knees, as I've been trained to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, to thank God for that day of sobriety. And on my knees, I blurted out, I said, God, what the hell's going on here? And the minute I said that, I knew what it was. And that intuitive place inside you where sometimes you get to just know stuff. I knew that the reason I'm so screwed up is that I've been stealing from my boss every single day for 7 or 8 months. Every single day. And acting like I'm such an upstanding member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And out of that came the knowledge of what I had to do, and I tell you, it terrified me. I knew I had to go to my boss and tell him I've been stealing from him. And the downside, there's 3 things wrong with that. First of all, I have watched him catch people stealing and throw them out. He's a great guy, but he has zero tolerance for thieves in the retail business, and you can't blame him, really. Secondly, I don't have the money to pay him back. I started doing the calculations, and it was hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and I don't have it. It wouldn't have been so bad if I had the money. I could have made the big ego gratifying grandiose gesture of gone in, given him the lump sum and pat myself on the back and see, fire me if you want, but look what a good guy I am. I stood up and made it right. But I don't even have the money. I'm going to have to humiliate myself, go to him, admit to what I've done, and get fired and then go get another job and make payments for probably a year to this guy. And you know what the worst thing of all was? Is that this guy that I got to go face has heard me prattle on at great length on various occasions about my rigorous program of honesty in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, man, I'm telling you, I don't want to do this. But I believed in my heart that if I didn't do it, that I'm probably going to drink again. I was really in a bad spot. And I went to him. And I broke down. I never felt so humiliated and so phony and so like a hypocrite and so, I felt like a facade human being. And I told him what I did, and he got pissed at me. But he didn't fire me. And I told him, I said, I will pay you back every single week. I will pay you back. And I'll tell you something. I did. Not only did I pay him back everything, I added on interest and another $50 because I know how I am. I'm a minimizer. It's too easy for me to minimize it and cut myself an edge. So I made sure I paid him back every plus. And I'll tell you some funny things that happened. I didn't put this together for some time later. Within 30 days, within a month of making the last payment to him and getting free, out of nowhere, a guy came to me and offered me a job for almost twice as much money with a potential for management in another retail store. And I went to him and I told him about it, gave him the 2 weeks' notice. He was fine with that. He said, it's a good opportunity. I can't give you an opportunity like that here. And I went to work for one of his competitors, and I went and I ended up managing that place, and I did very well for those people. And I never stole, I never took a pencil. I never took a dime from them. I gave them 110%. A couple years later, year and a half later maybe, I'm at a Denny's one night and I run into the guy that I'd stolen from and made the amends to. I said, how you doing? He said, doing fine. I said, what's going on? He said, well, he said, I tried to sell my store. He says, I really want to retire and burn out. And I got it back in my lap. The guy who tried to buy it was a Korean guy, and he couldn't get a license. They went to investigate him for the liquor license and the gaming license. He couldn't get it. It was too expensive to send the investigators back to Korea, and he just didn't want it. He wouldn't pay for it, and it fell through, and I ended up back in running the store again. He says, I'm really burnt out. He said, but I'm sure another buyer will come along, and I tell you, I don't know why I said this to him. To this day, I marvel at the fact that I said it. But I found myself saying to him, God, I'd sure like to buy your store. But I don't. Be a nice thought, but I don't have any money. He looked at me and he got a funny look on his face. He says, when's your day off? I told him, I said, why don't you meet me for lunch down here at Denny's on your day off? Meet me here at noon. I said, okay, meet you here at noon. I went down there at noon on my day off. He had all these papers lined up. And he showed me these figures of what the store was doing, and he said, he made me a proposition. He says, if you'll come back and run my business for me, and you can get the figures up to this level, because the business is not doing very good, but if you can get them up to this level, you will realize out of that an additional profit, which will go to you towards buying into the business. And if you can keep it up above this level for 5 years, at the end of that 5 years, you'll be able to buy me out. We'll be 50-50 partners. You'll have earned 50% of the store. And then you can buy me out and I can walk away from here. And I thought, oh my God, I got nothing to lose with this deal. And I went in there. That business was grossing about $600,000 a year. And I started practicing the principles that you taught me of how be of service and forget myself. And I'm not there for me, I'm there for you. And doing all that other centered stuff. And within 5 years, I had that business pumped up to a degree where it was making more money than anybody ever imagined. I ended up paying him. When it came time for me to buy him out of the half I didn't earn, he got twice as much as he would have gotten for the whole thing when I started there. That's how much I increased the value of the business. And I started opening other stores, one right after another, one after another, until at one point we were doing almost $10 million a year. And in early sobriety, I was on my knees in a cheap little apartment, and I had stolen from a guy, and I stood at a turning point. Maybe, Maybe I could have not drank and not made that amends. Maybe. I don't know. I've seen people not make amends and stay sober for a long time. Miserable. But I'll tell you something I know for sure. I would have never ended up with that business if I hadn't made that amends. And I made that amends in a lot of fear. And I made that amends secretly believing that I was going to be hurt from it. And I'll tell you what my experience has been. I've never been hurt or diminished from anything I've ever had to pay back. As a matter of fact, everything I ever had to pay back in amends has come back to me many, many times over. Every amends I've ever made has not diminished me. It has enhanced me. But I'll tell you, on the other side of it, before you make it, it looks very threatening, and it looks like, how am I going to live if I give them that money? How am I going to do it? And the people in AA that believe the fears in their head more than they trust in God and will not walk through the fear and ask for the willingness and make the amends, they seem to stay on the verge of financial ruin and distress for years here. And what I've discovered in financial difficulties in sobriety are not financial difficulties. They're usually a problem of unmade amends. I think that there's a spiritual principle that I cannot accept and hold to myself and own and claim anything that I secretly don't deserve. And if I ain't even, I can sweep it under the rug, but I can't fool the God within me. It's not that God wouldn't give me everything. He would. I'm his favorite kid. So are you. It's just I will throw it away and piss away anything I secretly don't think I deserve. I can't hold on to it. And the great thing about step 8 and 9 is that I craft myself by getting even to reverse my karma to become a worthy receiver so that when God gives me a good life, I don't have to sabotage my own life. Step 9 and step 10 and 11 are basically step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, all condensed in a daily process, along with the prayer and meditation. Because if I'm thorough about this process, I've opened a channel to an inspiration and intuitive thought. I've opened and unblocked a door to the God within me. And in step 11, it talks about if we keep the channel clear, that we will eventually start to rely on this intuition. What used to be an occasional hunch or inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. But it also warns in there that if I presume to be inspired at all times, I will pay for that presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. This month I'm 25 years sober, and I want to tell you that I am more sponsorable today and need sponsorship and direction in my life today, I think, more than I did when I was 3 or 4 years sober. And I'll tell you why. Because I got more to lose. And the more longevity I have in sobriety does not make my life more manageable by me. If anything, in my experience, it gives my alcoholic mind more information and ammunition to use to deceive me and delude me and to get me in trouble. And that's why I have a sponsor. And I'll say one little thing about sponsorship and then we're going to quit. The reason that God and I can't stand alone is that I do something in my head that is insidious, and it is my nature. I, instead of constantly adjusting my will and view of life to fit God's, I gradually start imagining his will as adjusting to mine. And what happens is a great example is the story of Jim Jones. Jim Jones, I believe, was an alcoholic. Jim Jones had a problem with drugs and alcohol as a child. As a teenager, he got in a lot of trouble with juvenile delinquency. And then he got saved. He had a born-again experience, and out of that born-again experience, he got a calling, and the calling was to go to school in the ministry and become a minister. And he did. He went to divinity school. He became a minister. And for a number of years, I believe, Jim Jones was connected, was an instrument of God. And Jim Jones went into the inner city, and he helped a lot of people down there, a lot of good stuff he did. But Jim Jones had the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And Jim Jones's view of God's will for him was never checked against anything except his own alcoholic mind. And slowly, incrementally, the self-centered fear and self-will just infiltrated his consciousness so gradually and subtly that he gradually moved and got sicker and sicker, and he never knew that he was moving in that direction. If Jim Jones would have had a sponsor, at the very least, I'm sure his sponsor would have said, "Jim, the Kool-Aid is a bad idea." But Jim drank that Kool-Aid and killed himself and had all those people in Jonestown commit suicide. And the tragic thing is he did it believing he was doing God's will. And I think that I could get that crazy. I think without a sponsorship, without a good sponsor and accountability to the guys I sponsor, and that is so, I tell you, there's nothing, I can't imagine my life without the people I sponsor, because sponsorship, doing 12-step work and sponsoring guys integrates itself through the whole 12-step process. How does a guy like me become entirely ready to give up some stuff that he still thinks kind of works? Except one day you realize that all these guys you sponsor, that you are the first example of Alcoholics Anonymous they ever see. And when I start to get that, I start to realize there's some things in me I don't like. I don't want to be a bad example to them. If it was just me, I might have went with the illusion of gratification and held on to some of that stuff for a while. But you see, one of the things that I've awakened to as a result of these steps is that my actions, in essence, are my vote for how I think you should do your life and how you should do AA. To some of us that have been sober a while, much is given and much is expected. I have guys that look to me as their primary example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you something. If it was just me, I wouldn't give a shit. But I love them. And I don't want to be a bad example to them. And that has given me a willingness, and it forced me in some areas of my life to become entirely ready in some things that I don't think I would have done on my own. See, it's the newcomers in the 12-step work is really God's catalyst to do what I ask him to do in step 3. I said, "Relieve me of the bondage of self." And you know what he does? He sends me on 12-step calls. He puts guys in my life that ask me to sponsor him, that listen to, that tell me their fourth and fifth steps, that ask for help with their amends. And through my attention being focused on them, I become other-centered at times in my life, and I'm relieved of the bondage of self. I've been very fortunate that I am the type of alcoholic that I can't live without this whole package. And I know that because I have tried. And the pain, you know why I think guys like me become fundamentalists and want to do it all and don't want anything, we don't want any of the therapy anymore, we don't want any of this crap, we want to do AA, is because we've tried all of that other crap and it hurts too much. Here, this works. This works. I want to thank you guys for sitting through. It's been a long day. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come up here. If my experience has been useful at all, I want to thank you for the opportunity. You want to join me in closing in the Lord's Prayer?